Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Israel's recent raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds sparked protests and condemnations around the world. At least 33 people are killed and many more wounded after a bomb blast rips through a mosque during Friday prayers in northern Afghanistan. And Muslims in Iran and other parts of the world mark Laylatul Qadr, the occasion when the Holy Quran was revealed in its entirety to the Prophet of Islam. Hello and welcome. We're coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Tensions simmering in occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli forces have once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. So far, dozens of Palestinians have been injured. Israeli forces made arrests, too. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to the latest attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque. The movement said it's closely monitoring the situation there, and it's fully ready to respond to Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people. Hamas also called on the international community to restrain the occupying Israeli regime and stop its aggression against Al-Aqsa. Tensions at the holy site began last Friday when Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers, injuring scores. The aggression has taken place during the fasting month of Ramadan. Thousands of people have taken to the streets in the Gaza Strip to support Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds. Ashraf Shannon has more details in the following report.
A big rally was held in the besieged Gaza Strip to support Al-Quds in the face of rising Israeli aggression against the Holy City. Thousands of people from all walks of life came out to express their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks. Tensions have been on the rise in recent days as extremist Israeli settlers, backed by Israeli regime forces, desecrated the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and slammed the silence of Arab countries towards the Israeli crimes. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the Friday rally, warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
We will not leave Al-Quds as a prey for the Zionist enemy, and our people are united today in defending Al-Quds. The Palestinian resistance is very strong and will defend Al-Quds against Zionist attacks. Today's rally and the masses here are sending a strong message to the Zionist enemy. If these Zionist attacks against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque don't come to an end, our people will explode in the face of the Zionist entity.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, the Israeli forces and illegal settlers have been trying to prevent Palestinians from gathering and performing their religious duties at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to show our solidarity and support for Al-Quds in the face of Zionist aggressions. All Palestinian resistance groups are here to send a message of unity. We will spare no effort to protect Al-Quds, and we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support the resistance and help us to protect Al-Quds and the Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Muslims across Pakistan have held protests to show solidarity with Palestinians over the ongoing Israeli crackdown at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Mohammed Touri reports from Karachi.
Braving the scorching heat while fasting, protesters took to the streets after Friday prayers across Pakistan to voice solidarity with Palestinians as tension continued to simmer in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli forces once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Protesters here are outraged over what they call the double standards of the international community and the way they view Ukraine compared to Palestine.
Double standards is the biggest issue with international community. East Timor, South Sudan, Kashmir, Palestine, you name it. When Muslims are victims, they will always turn their backs on us. Therefore, I think it's about time to put an end to this collective behavior against Muslims on international stage.
Actually, We are, being a Muslim, Al-Aqsa, the Muslims over there are brothers and sisters. If they're in pain, we are feeling the same pain in our body. The whole Muslim Ummah is like a one body. If one part feels is in pain, the whole body feels the pain. So we are feeling that pain, and we are gathered here to tell the world that they are not alone. We are with them.
Speakers at the rally stress upon the need of unity among the Muslim world.
We are who are gathered over here because of, as you know, the situation which is going on in Palestine. Israelis are continuously terrorizing or they are attacking the innocent people of Palestine. That's why we are gathering in the protest to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Again, you know, the Jews, army and the military, paramilitary forces, they are not letting the Muslims over there freely praying and offering their rituals of the Ramadan. And everybody knows this is the holiest month of Ramadan, and this is very sacred to the Muslim.
The Israeli aggression against Palestinians has once again escalated during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians have been injured by the Israeli forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque over the past few days. Mohammed Touri, Karachi.
The Israeli embassy in London was targeted by a demonstration of furious pro-Palestine activists who condemned the recent attacks against unarmed Palestinian worshippers this Ramadan. The protesters hope to send a strong message of solidarity to the Palestinians and vent at the UK's leadership who routinely facilitate Israeli aggression. Jordanians take to the streets of the capital Amman in solidarity with the Palestinians amid intensified Israeli assaults on worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. The protesters say the Jordanian government must expel the Israeli ambassador and scrap a peace treaty signed with the regime. Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman Safadi, recently summoned Israel's charge d'affaires to protest recent Israeli brutality at Al-Aqsa Mosque and its vicinity in the occupied old city of Al-Quds. Last week, over 75 Jordanian lawmakers also called for severing ties with the Tel Aviv regime and suspending all bilateral agreements. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations denounces Israel's latest attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque and killing of Palestinians by the regime in Al-Quds. Majid Takht-Ravanchi called for immediate action by the international community, especially the UN, to end Israeli occupation and acts of aggression. Takht-Ravanchi made the remarks in a meeting of Islamic countries' ambassadors in New York, where the UN Secretary General was also present. The meeting focused on the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli forces over the past days. Delegates of other Islamic nations also highlighted the UN's role in achieving a fair resolution to the Palestinian issue. Iran's foreign minister has reiterated that the United States should abandon its excessive demands in order to revive the 2015 deal. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the White House should work toward a resolution to the Vienna talks. He says the current U.S. administration should have the courage to correct the country's previous mistakes. He made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. The European official said continuation of the break in the negotiations is not constructive. Borrell proposed renewed contact between Iran's chief negotiator and EU's representative on the talks. Tehran says it's ready to return to the talks once Washington makes the needed political decisions on the outstanding issues. Several blasts have hit different parts of Afghanistan in the past week, killing and injuring scores of people. We'll discuss that in our news review program. Here's the full story and our guest's take on the matter.
News review program now, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. And yet another bombing in Afghanistan. A blast tore through a mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. Taliban spokesman says the explosion left over 33 people dead and 43 others injured. There's been no claim of responsibility for this attack, which follows multiple blasts claimed by the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in the country. The Taliban say they've arrested a Daesh member in connection with a Thursday bomb attack at a Shia mosque in Mazar-e-Sharif. They say that he was the mastermind behind that deadly blast. Local sources say over three dozen people were killed in the Mazar-e-Sharif bombing. Now on Thursday, Kunduz was also rocked in a similar attack where four people died there. Major cities in Afghanistan have been reeling from bomb attacks since the Taliban takeover in August 2021. Now joining us for the program is Mr. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Bristol, and Ian Williams, journalist and analyst and writer, joining us from New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Ian, we'll start with you. Why do you think we're seeing this uptick in these terror attacks on Afghan soil, especially in the holy fasting month of Ramadan?
Well, it's the time that the fanatics will pick as especially holy a month, and since these attacks are on what they regard as heretics, Shia mosques, they think they're doing Allah's work, I suppose. It's more interesting to see how the Taliban have really failed to establish control, because they dissolved the previous state and they haven't replaced it with an apparatus of their own. Having warriors wandering around with AK-47s is not the same as establishing the institutions that the previous state at least vestigially had. I presume that's their problem now, is that they really do not have control, and the Takfiris, as you call them, can infiltrate and work at their will without any impediment from the local authorities, because there aren't any local authorities. The Taliban, mostly Pashtun, were never very strong in the north anyway. That was the bedrock of the resistance to them. That's why they were called the Northern Warlords. And the Hazara people, who are being singled out for attack, were pretty much marginalized by all of the major groups in Afghan society. They've always been outsiders. I mean, I'm not saying that in a derogatory way, that they've been forced to be outsiders.
Thank you, Ian. And Tony, welcome to the program there, bud. So, Tony, your initial thoughts on these attacks, and when it comes to the Taliban providing, to Ian's point, security for the Shia community in Afghanistan, the last few days we've seen multiple mosques and educational centers targeted, leaving dozens dead. Are we seeing incompetence to provide security by the Taliban, or something, do you think, more sinister? Your initial thoughts on this.
Well, look, the question is, who are these fanatics? Ian's quite rightly pointed out they are fanatics, but who are they? What is their motivation? Is it really this kind of idea that the Shia want to kill the Sunnis, the Sunni want to kill the Shia? We had a very similar conflict over here in Northern Ireland in the latter part of the last century, called the Troubles, where supposedly that was all about Catholics wanting to kill Protestants and Protestants wanting to kill Catholics. But I can tell you, and I lived over there for a year, right on the border of Northern Ireland, which was called Bandit Country, and it was really nothing to do with the religion and the faith. What it was a practice ground for the army, where they were practicing urban warfare, and also it was an attempt to set these two religious communities against each other. Largely, you know, it was actually faith that brought them together eventually and signed the Good Friday Agreement. So, you know, I look at many of these so-called religious conflicts around the world as an attempt to create a religious conflict by other fanatics. In this case, almost certainly, I would say, the United States Central Intelligence Agency and their colleagues in MI6 and the Mossad. They are the ones that like to see these religions fighting each other. They think that, you know, this is a great idea to keep the people down. And there are, of course, as people may know, some of your viewers may realize, there is a whole philosophical cult around starting religious wars, particularly evident down at the Al-Aqsa Mosque last weekend and during the week, where there is an attempt to try and get the Zionists fighting with the Palestinians and make out that it's a religious battle. Actually, the Jews that are behind that are not religious Jews. They're secular Jews for the large part. And if they say they're religious, they're fanatical. So there's a definite attempt to start these. And
stay safe, both of you. Always a pleasure checking with you both. Ian Williams out of New York and Tony Gosling there from Bristol. And that's a wrap, this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Iranians are marking Laylatul Qadr, or the Night of Destiny, the occasion when the Holy Quran was revealed to the Prophet of Islam some 14 centuries ago. Yusuf Jalali has this report from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam in Iran's northeastern city of Mashhad.
whispers with God on a night that's believed by Muslims to be a time when their wishes are fulfilled. It's called Laylatul Qadr, or the Night of Destiny. Muslims observe the occasion every year in the month of Ramadan, when they congregate at religious sites to pray and make wishes. To Iranians, no place is better than the shrine of the 8th Shia Imam Reza in the city of Mashhad to keep vigil on the occasion.
Words cannot describe my feelings tonight. It's a night of destiny when God has promised to listen to our prayers. It's a night which the Quran says is better than 1,000 months. I'm so happy to be in Imam Reza's shrine on this divine night.
After 2 years, we once again can visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, our beloved Imam, and that on the night of destiny. I wish that God will eradicate the coronavirus once and for all, for us to be able to live peacefully and visit our holy sites.
Islamic scriptures say Laylatul Qadr marks the night when the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. The Quran says on this night, angels descend on earth to listen to the prayers of worshippers.
We believe that on the night of destiny, angels come to earth upon God's order. The Quran says in its verses that the book was revealed to the Prophet on this night, and the angels will stay on earth till dawn. That's why we never miss out on this holy night and come here to pray.
No exact date is provided for the Night of Destiny, but all Islamic references are unanimous that the Quran was revealed to the Prophet on one of three different dates, the 19th, the 21st, or the 23rd night of the holy month of Ramadan.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that the Night of Destiny is marked without serious concerns over the coronavirus, and this has attracted this huge number of pilgrims to the shrine of Imam Reza to once again mark Laylatul Qadr en masse, and at the same time, reunite with their 8th Imam after 2 years. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Even before hostilities broke out, the CEOs of U.S. major weapons firms were talking about how tensions in Europe could pad their profits. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by William Harting and Julia Glitil, political analyst. This article is published under the heading Pentagon Contractors Seizing New Gold Rush to Cash In on Russia-Ukraine Crisis. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. For U.S. arms makers, however, the greatest benefits of the war in Ukraine won't be immediate weapon sales, large as they are, but the changing nature of the ongoing debate over Pentagon spending itself. Of course, the representatives of such companies were already plugging the long-term challenge posed by some countries, a greatly exaggerated threat. Even before the war, the Pentagon was slated to receive at least $7.3 trillion over the next decade, more than four times the cost of President Biden's $1.7 trillion domestic Build Back Better plan, already stymied by members of Congress who labeled it too expensive by far. And keep in mind that, given the current surge in Pentagon spending, that $7.3 trillion could prove a minimal figure. In another era, that budget request for fiscal year 2023 would have been mind-boggling, since it's higher than spending at the peaks of conflicts in Korea and Vietnam, and over $100 billion more than the Pentagon received annually at the height of the Cold War. Despite its size, however, congressional Republicans, joined by a significant number of their Democratic colleagues, are already pushing for more. 30 Republican members of the House and Senate Armed Services Committee have, in fact, signed a letter to President Biden calling for 5% growth in military spending beyond inflation, which would potentially add up to $100 billion to that budget request. Typically enough, Representative Ilani Luria, who represents the area near the Huntington Ingalls Company's Newport News Military Shipyard in Virginia, accused the U.S. administration of gutting the Navy because it contemplates decommissioning some older ships to make way for new ones. That complaint was lodged despite that service's plan to spend a whopping $28 billion on new ships in fiscal year 2023. That planned increase in shipbuilding funds is part of a proposed pool of $276 billion for weapons procurement, as well as further research and development, contained in the new budget, which is where the top five weapons-producing contractors, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman, make most of their money. Those firms already split more than $150 billion in Pentagon contracts annually, a figure that will skyrocket if the administration and Congress have their way. To put all of this in context, just one of those top firms, Lockheed Martin, was awarded $75 billion in Pentagon contracts in fiscal year 2020 alone. That's considerably more than the entire budget for the State Department, dramatic evidence of how skewed Washington's priorities are, despite the Biden administration's pledge to put diplomacy first. The Pentagon's weapons wish list for fiscal year 2023 is a catalog of just how the big contractors will cash in. For example, the new Columbia-class ballistic missile submarine built by General Dynamics Electric Boat Plant in southeastern Connecticut will see its proposed budget for fiscal year 2023 grow from $5 billion to $6.2 billion. Spending on Northrop Grumman's new intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, the ground-based strategic deterrent, will increase by about one-third annually to $3.6 billion. The category of missile defense and defeat, a specialty of Boeing, Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin, is slated to receive more than $24 billion. And the space-based missile warning systems, a staple of the Trump administration created a Space Force, will jump from $2.5 billion in fiscal year 2022 to $4.7 billion in this year's proposed budget. A number of the weapon systems, which in the Ukraine moment are guaranteed to be showered with cash, are so dangerous or so dysfunctional that, like the F-35, they should actually be phased out. Take the new ICBM. Former Secretary of Defense William Perry has called ICBMs some of the most dangerous weapons in the world, because a president would only have minutes to decide whether to launch them in a crisis, greatly increasing the risk of an accidental nuclear war based on a false alarm. Nor does it make sense to buy aircraft carriers at $13 billion a pop, especially since the latest version is having trouble even launching and landing aircraft, its primary function, and is increasingly vulnerable to attack by next-generation high-speed missiles. The few positives in the new budget, like the Navy's decision to retire the unnecessary and unworkable littoral combat ship, a sort of F-35 of the sea designed for multiple tasks, none of which it does well, could easily be reversed by advocates from states and districts where those systems are built and maintained. The U.S. House of Representatives, for instance, has a powerful Joint Strike Fighter Caucus, which in 2021 mustered more than one-third of all House members to press for more F-35s than the Pentagon and Air Force requested, as they will no doubt do again this year. A shipbuilding caucus co-chaired by Representatives Joe Courtney and Rob Whitman will fight against the Navy's plan to retire old ships to buy new ones. Similarly, the ICBM coalition, made up of senators from states with either ICBM bases or production centers, has a near-perfect record of staving off reductions in the deployment or funding of those weapons and will, in 2022, be hard at work defending its budgetary allocation. Coming up, with a sensible, realistic, and affordable defense policy, always a challenge, will be even more so in the midst of the Ukrainian nightmare. Still, given where American taxpayer dollars go, it remains all too worthwhile. Such a new approach should include things like reducing the numbers of Pentagon's private contractors. Hundreds of thousands of people, many of whom are engaged in thoroughly redundant jobs that could be done more cheaply by civilian government employees or simply eliminated. It's estimated that cutting spending on contractors by 15% would save around $262 billion over 10 years. The Pentagon's three-decades-long nearly $2 trillion modernization plan to build a new generation of nuclear-armed bombers, missiles, and submarines, along with new warheads, should, for instance, simply be scrapped in keeping with the kind of deterrence-only nuclear strategy developed by the nuclear policy organization Global Zero. And the staggering American global military footprint, an invitation to further conflict that includes more than 750 military bases scattered on every continent except Antarctica, and counter-terror operations in 85 countries, should, at the very least, be sharply scaled back. According to the Center for International Policy Sustainable Defense Task Force, and a study of alternative approaches to defense carried by Congressional Budget Office, even a relatively minimalist strategic rethinking could save at least $1 trillion over the next decade, enough to make a healthy down payment on investments in public health, preventing or mitigating the worst potential impacts of climate change, or beginning the task of narrowing record levels of income inequality. Of course, none of these changes can occur without challenging the power and influence of the military-industrial congressional complex, a task as urgent as it is difficult in this moment of carnage in Europe. No matter how hard it may be, it's a fight worth having, both for the security of the world and the future of the planet. One thing is guaranteed. A new gold rush of defense spending is a disaster in the making for all of people not in that complex. Food for thought. Salam and condolences to you on the eve of the martyrdom anniversary of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, following the fatal sword blow he received on his head during the morning prayer in the Grand Mosque of Kufa. During his last hours, Asbaq ibn Nabata, one of his companions, visited him and asked him for some words of advice. Imam Ali, peace upon him, replied, "O Asbaq, what can be greater counsel than the fact that yesterday I was your companion, today I am your guest, and tomorrow I will only be a memory."
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The fasting of the month of Ramadan is an important pillar of
worship. إنما سمي رمضان لأنه يرمض الذنوب.
Verily, the month of Ramadan has been thus named because it scorches away sins.
What does Maha Ramadan mean to us?
This is Dialogue, a program on the holy month of Ramadan and the importance of fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program. This is Dialogue. We're talking about the blessed and holy month of Ramadan. The holy month of Ramadan, as you all know, is the blessed and honorable month when the doors of the Almighty Allah's mercy are open. It is the blessed month when forgiveness is easy to gain, but only if we take our steps in this direction. The holy month of Ramadan, the great month when the doors of hell are closed. A beautiful, a blessed, an honorable month, a month where we return towards the Almighty Allah. the holy month of Ramadan, a month where we gain our provisions for our journey towards the hereafter. The holy month of Ramadan, where we establish a connection with our loving, nurturing Lord, our Creator and Sustainer, Allah, exalted and glorified is He. The holy month of Ramadan, the greatest of months, the most honorable of months. This month in which we can return towards Allah. This month in which we can reconnect with Allah. This month in which we can gain the provisions for the hereafter. This, the holy month of Ramadan.
قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله من لم يغفر له في شهر رمضان ففي أي شهر يغفر له.
Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم stated, if a person remains unforgiven in the month of Ramadan, then what other month is there left for him to be forgiven in?
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are blessed to be living and breathing and, inshallah, fasting in this holy month of Ramadan. Now, in this holy month of Ramadan, of course, we all know that we fast from food and water and various other things. But there is one other thing that we should fast from. Now, fasting, in this meaning that I'm trying to talk about, is in reality refraining from doing something. So when we fast from food and drink, we are refraining from food and drink. Well, I want to add one more thing that we should fast from. And perhaps it's not one of those things that will break our fast, but it is definitely one of those things which will make our fasting in this holy month of Ramadan so much more powerful. And that is to fast and refrain from sin. Brothers and sisters, sometimes we do not realize what sinning is. In reality, sinning is the disobedience to the Almighty Allah. And when we realize that we are disobeying the Almighty Allah, sinning becomes much more difficult. And there are so many different types of sins. Sins which we commit when we are heedless. And they're not consistently committed. They happen every now and then. Or they are sins which we have decided upon. We wanted to do something bad, but we didn't act upon it. Or there are sins that have been committed, but then forgiveness and repentance is asked for and they are forgiven. Or sins that have no punishment promised for them. Or sins that have not had a punishment assigned to them. But despite the different kinds of sins and despite the different types of sins, we need to realize that sin is in reality disobedience to Allah. And no matter how insignificant a sin might seem, it is still disobeying Allah. In this holy month of Ramadan, we should try our best to prevent ourselves from committing sins, especially since this is the month in which the shayateen are chained. This is Dialogue, the holy month of Ramadan.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam says, Shaitan flows through our blood. In order to stop him, make sure you fast. So whenever you find, not only in Maha Ramadan, in any time where you feel that you are spiritually low, where you feel that connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala during the rest of the year is not there, start fasting. Start fasting and you will see that a connection being established up there. So let us consider, why did Allah ordain fasting for us? Allah has kept us whereby He allows us to eat and drink, and the body demands that on a regular basis. He allows us to eat for 11 months, and on the 9th month of the Islamic year, He all of a sudden says, stop. No eating, no drinking, no smoking, not this, not that. All of these prohibitions between Fajr up to Maghrib. Why? Ya Allah, don't you realize what happens to me when this happens? My blood pressure goes up, right? My heart palpitations go up. If you look at me the wrong way, then I'm ready to eat you alive, right? And so on and so forth. So we go through major withdrawal symptoms. And so it goes to a stage whereby I get upset at the slightest thing. Then why, Allah, have you brought all this onto me? Or in other words, if the food is not ready at Maghrib time and my wife tells me that I will only put the food after you pray Maghrib, after the whole household prays Maghrib, then we will have food, we will break the fast, then there is Qiyamah in the household, right? Don't you know what is going to happen to me? When it is time to pray Fajr or Dhuhr or Asr, and she tells, wakes me up and says, you know, it's time for prayer, it's Aynul Waqt, why don't you get up and pray? I tell her, well, there's plenty of time before Qadha. I will pray. What's the problem? Let me sleep right now. Okay? So all these things are happening. What is happening is that my whole system is turning upside down. There is a revolution that is happening within my body and my system is all over the place. So I ask Allah, why Allah are you putting me through all this trouble? Perhaps, this is my thought process only, perhaps Allah with a smile will say, I know. I'm doing it purposely. Because when your life is in a straight line and you are there comfortable in your own ways, you forget about me. When I turn your world upside down, that is when you remember me. And that is when I want you to come back to me, because you are mine. I have created you for me.
يا أول كل شيء وآخر يا إله.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. كل شيء ومليك يا رب كل شيء وسان يا خالق كل شيء.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Iran's National Museum is displaying a collection of artifacts that was stolen decades ago, but has finally returned home after a long legal battle. The items, which include sacred figurines, pots and jars, date back to more than 3,000 years ago. that were stolen and sent to the West more than four decades ago. In 1991, the British Museum was seeking to buy the collection from a smuggler residing in Switzerland. The objects, however, were seized by Swiss police and revealed in court in 2008. Since then, Iran had been trying to get the stolen treasures back home.
Under pressure from the Iranian diplomatic apparatus and the official complaints of the National Museum in 2015, the legal process continued, and finally on December 20, 2020, the collection returned to us.
The collection belongs to the northwestern city of Bukhan, which was the home of Manians around the 10th to 7th centuries BC. The Manians were one of the first nomadic tribes to build cities in that area. The director of Iran's National Museum says the effort to recover other stolen artifacts continues. The country is now holding talks with the U.S. and Australia to return ancient objects smuggled over there. Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turn barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most. Magic returns to Belgium with a purple carpet of bluebells covering the undergrowth of Hallerbos woods near Brussels. Each spring, this beech forest turns into a bluebell spectacular, turning the area into a natural wonderland. Millions of these blooming flowers sprout up across the 550-hectare woods, filling the air with their sweet aroma. The short but enchanting blooming phase offers nature enthusiasts a one-of-a-kind experience.
It is an outstanding and magical place because whenever we come, there's an amazing atmosphere. The sunrise was truly beautiful this morning, and we know this offers the opportunity to take great photos and decorate our house. It is a great comfort during these tough times.
Visitors can stroll the winding paths and watch rabbits and deer wandering through the woods. The forest floor blooms for a period of 7 to 10 days. After this time, leaves begin to grow on the trees above them, blocking the sunlight from reaching the flowers. The phenomenon of bluebell forest is not uncommon in Europe, but the Hallerbos greenery is unique for the density and beauty of its blossoms. A huge pink moon has glowed over Chilean skies, mesmerizing stargazers and ordinary citizens alike. The full moon was completely visible over the capital, Santiago. The celestial phenomenon is called a pink moon as it appears in April and is named after an American plant, pink plot, that blooms in spring. The pink moon will shine during the weekend through early Monday and may be visible in most parts of the world. The phenomenon also marks the calendar for different religious festivities around the globe.
A batch of autonomous delivery vehicles has been provided to facilitate personnel and volunteers in the streets and communities of Shanghai. The self-driving vehicles distribute supplies to residents in the Chinese megacity, which is now hit hard by the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. The vehicles reduce person-to-person contact and largely lower the risk of infection. A community served by the distribution station has more than 30 apartment buildings and nearly 3,000 residents. The weight of each order is more than 5 kilograms, which puts great pressure on the volunteers to deliver. 49 autonomous delivery vehicles have been sent to communities, colleges, and hospitals in Shanghai to support anti-pandemic and supply work.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Sunny skies and spring temperatures made for the perfect setting for the 65th birthday of Fatu, the world's oldest gorilla living at Berlin Zoo. At this age, the Western Lowland gorilla is what Berlin Zoo calls almost something of a legend. Gorillas living in the wild have a life expectancy of about 40 years, and at 65, she has been the world's oldest living gorilla for a while. 65 is absolutely extraordinary, and that obviously needs to be celebrated in style.
They mainly get vegetables, and the sugar they receive at most is fruit sugar, and that's what she saw for today in the shape of raspberries and blueberries. They were the decoration on rice cake made of boiled rice, a thin layer of rice, and some curd so it sticks together. The bottom was made of a lot of green stuff, then the lion and lettuce.
According to Berlin Zoo, Western Lowland gorillas are now an endangered species after their natural habitat was continuously decimated, and therefore fewer and fewer animals live in the tropical rainforest of Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Gabon, and the Republic of Congo. The World of Opera is opening its doors to the deaf community for the very first time. The Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra has teamed up with the Deaf West Theater to stage a production of Beethoven's only opera, Fidelio, at their home at the Walt Disney Hall. The chorus will be performed by the White Hands Choir, a group from Venezuela consisting of disabled children and young adults who sing as well as sign. The production pairs up a singer and a deaf actor to both inhabit the one role on stage. Having deaf actors perform alongside opera singers, however, has its challenges, not least of which is keeping up the rhythm of the music.
I think probably that there's a lot of tempo that I've been rehearsing. A lot of times when the singers hold the same word, but the next time they say that exact same word in the next few bars, they don't hold it as long. So trying to remember all of those is very difficult. So are they holding this for four beats or two beats? Or what word is this in this thing?
The challenge with opera is that it's very fluid and it's not repetitive. The tempos change throughout it, and night to night it even changes. The conductor, you know, kind of changes how he conducts things each night, and so that is something that is challenging.
The opera singers also give small cues to the actors, like opening a letter or sitting down or standing up, to keep them informed where they are in the piece. The deaf cast use theatrical ASL, or American Sign Language, in the production. DJ Kurse, the producer at the Deaf West Theater, says the performance is a little bit more poetic and a little bit more kind of picturesque.
A startup in the U.S. state of California is turning science fiction into reality by sending tiny robots on a fantastic voyage inside humans to treat brain disorders. The smart cells are small enough to be injected and can be carefully guided through the brain using magnetic coils placed outside of the patient's skull. The coils are linked to a computer that can remotely maneuver the robots through delicate pathways into the affected part of the brain. The micro-robots are also removed by rewinding them through the same route. The developers at Bionaut Labs say these robots are extremely important when it comes to zero-failure-sensitive surgeries.
For localized conditions such as cancer tumors, stroke, atherosclerotic plaque buildup, localized pain, and many other conditions, there is a real need to have a micro-robotic, precise, remote-controlled mechanism that can treat a condition only at a specific point and nowhere else.
The startup has already tested the robots on large animals. Inventors hope to use the robot to pierce fluid-filled cysts within the brain when clinical trials on humans begin in 2 years. If approved, they could offer key advantages over more invasive and dangerous treatments for brain disorders. Floating solar panels help landowners benefit from underused body of water. Now, a German company is covering 14,000 square meters of a lake with these panels, turning it into the biggest solar park in the country. The park is built by a family-owned company called Quartzwerk, which specializes in extracting and processing industrial minerals. The company says it wants to become independent of fossil energy sources amid rising energy prices. The head of the Floating Panel Corporation says they will be generating around 3 million kilowatts per hour of green electricity on the surfaces of Limmersheim Lake in southern Germany.
The
plant can make a super big contribution to the land-neutral energy transition, because here an unused lake that was previously used for gravel extraction is being converted into a power plant for renewable energy.
Installation and maintenance of the panels are easy and safe, while they also offer a significant reduction in evaporation from the water surface. According to the company, this will save around 1,100 tons of carbon dioxide each year.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.